Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of Business Beyond Borders, where we have made it our mission to talk to global experts and professionals, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and founders from a variety of industries and fields as we tackle the many aspects of scaling an international business. The goal here is to collect valuable insights and share in-depth knowledge so that you too can apply the winning techniques and strategies to go global and take your business to the world.
Hi there, I'm Cynthia Dearen, and this is the Business Beyond Borders podcast, where I talk to business leaders and experts about creating international business success. Today, I'm joined by my friend and colleague, David McCready, OBE, CEO of the Australia-British Chamber of Commerce. David, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Thanks very much for having me, Cynthia. It's a pleasure to talk to you as always.
So I want to start off by looking back at what's happened in the UK over the last 18 months. 2020, 2021 was a kind of perfect storm for the UK, wasn't it? We had a testy Brexit that only got done at the last moment, and then hot on its heels, a COVID-19 pandemic that wreaked havoc on the population and saw Britain plunge into a lockdown that lasted, nearly 6 months? What I was wondering is, what has been most striking for you about the circumstances in the United Kingdom over the last 18 months, and how do you think it's affected the relationship with Australia?
Yeah, thanks, Cynthia. It has without doubt been, I think for all of us anywhere around the world, a most extraordinary, 18 months that we've gone through since COVID came out. And as you rightly point out, the UK was on an interesting course anyway, with Brexit unfolding and deals getting done, and lots of things to look at and consider and figure out for how it wanted to engage with the world in this new environment that it found itself in, separated, although still connected very much to the EU in various ways. Brexit formally occurred at the end of January last year, and the extension of the transition period until the end of 2020 was obviously a very good thing for a whole bunch of reasons, not least of which, a pandemic on top of everything else was going to make life incredibly difficult if that hadn't happened. And the fact that the EU and the UK came to an arrangement in the TCA, the Trade and Cooperation Agreement that it signed, very much at the 11th hour when all good deals with the EU are signed, something I think I've said to many people over a number of years, that nothing would happen until the very last moment. And then the question was, when was the very last moment? And obviously throughout the process, we saw a number of times where that sort of kept being extended for various reasons, the Article 50 provisions on a number of occasions, for example. So, yeah, it has been a perfect storm, and the UK really got hammered early in the pandemic. I was in the UK in March last year when Boris Johnson came on the television on a Sunday night and said, if you can work from home tomorrow instead of coming into the office, please do that. It was very similar timing to when Australia's own Scott Morrison said very similar things from the Prime Minister's chair here in Australia. And basically from there, over the next month or so, the UK really got hammered. They didn't control the early outbreaks well at all. They got to a position where they basically felt that everybody was going to get it, and there was a level of herd immunity that they were hoping might come through and help them at some point. The reality is that they lost about 20% of GDP in that quarter and really felt a lot of the worst possible effects economically, obviously health-wise. It was a tremendous tragedy with, literally thousands of people passing away, and the records show that they were one of the worst affected countries, certainly up to this point. And we know that the pandemic's still going in other countries, notably India and elsewhere, that are really struggling with their third wave of problems. But I guess economically, things with the transition period extending to the end of the year sort of helped guide them through a little bit in that period. And the agreement in the TCA for zero tariff, zero quota trade between the EU and the UK to continue forward is obviously a great, great stepping stone. I note there are still a lot of services, particularly interests, that need to still be ironed out. There's some goods arrangements which aren't quite finalised either, particularly around automotive parts. Financial services, they're still negotiating some pieces around that as well. So it's not a done deal by any stretch. But I think the pleasing thing is, whilst there was certainly a big pause in the first quarter of this year as those new arrangements came into play, the more recent numbers seem to indicate a return to a level of normality of trade between the EU and the UK, and a lot of the problems of, you know, understanding the new paperwork requirements and so forth seem to have been addressed now. Will that be the case going forward? Are we just perhaps in a purple patch at the moment? I'm not in a position to, my crystal ball isn't as clear as I might like, perhaps. I think there's certainly some great optimism that the UK and European Union trading relationship will continue to be a strong one. And some of the worst effects that we're worried about if there was no deal at all have certainly been avoided, which is terrific to see. And you mentioned the lockdown that the UK's been through. They've had an interesting ride comparatively to Australia, where, there was sort of an initial lockdown, then it was sort of opened up for the summertime and people travelled internationally. And then obviously that didn't work out so well as it came into the colder months towards Christmas. And then this lockdown that they really have found very challenging in the first half of this year, which they're only starting to emerge from. And I know we're talking on a very important day, Monday the 17th of May, as they open pubs properly, not just beer gardens, for UK citizens to be able to enjoy a pint and a feed at inside the local pub for the first time for some months. So hopefully the trajectory that the Prime Minister has outlined continues to be met, and we're all obviously concerned about the latest Indian variation that's also now happening in the UK. But it's interesting to note that, the numbers of infections are well down as about 1,000 cases a day, which is well down off the peak earlier in the year of over 60,000 cases a day. And the number of deaths is very, very low comparatively as well. So that combined with an extraordinary rollout of vaccines, over 30 million people have got their first dose. That represents, I think, more than 50% of the adult population. And also, I think now over 20 million have had the second jab as well. So the story is somewhat turned, and I think the tide has changed. And the second half of 2021 and into 2022 could perhaps really see a wonderful renaissance for the British economy.
And do you think this combination of Brexit and COVID, I mean, can you see any impact on the relationship with Australia that you can identify? Has it been for better or for worse?
I guess there are a number of different parts to that question. Obviously, in terms of Brexit, Australia are now in a position with the UK having a control of its own trade policy for the first time in effectively about 40 years, are in a position that we can negotiate a free trade agreement, and we're in the middle of a 5-week sprint. It's described that Minister Tehan and Secretary of State Truss discussed and put in place when they met face-to-face in April in London, with the aim of having an agreement in principle to be signed by the two prime ministers in June when the G7 takes place. They're also very upfront that won't be the end of the negotiation. It will be probably a little bit of time after that for I's to be dotted and T's to be crossed and the final text to emerge. And there'll be probably one or two items still to be negotiated after that point. But it certainly feels like the momentum's well up. Every night, I understand, negotiators are meeting from both sides, and there's a weekly call between the minister and the secretary of state. So, all of those things sort of bode well for a sort of rapid conclusion, hopefully, to that agreement. More broadly, Australia and the UK have put in place a number of other agreements. So, the Space Bridge came into play earlier this year. There was also a defence cooperation agreement around defence industry procurement that's come into play earlier this year as well. So there's some great things happening on that front. We've also heard, obviously, that the Queen Elizabeth aircraft carrier group is on its way to our part of the world, showing some strengthening engagement there. But there's also a lot happening, sort of a little bit more behind the scenes, you might say, with things as simple as the New South Wales Health Department providing advice to the UK on how they've done hotel quarantine, There's been pieces in infrastructure and transport that have been lined up as well that the people are exchanging views on. And so, you know, business is sort of ticking away in the background. But obviously, whilst Australia remains in a situation where our borders are closed and we can't travel easily to the UK nor have UK visitors here, it's obviously made things a little bit more challenging. So that's why it was so impressive for Trade Minister to go to the UK and have that face-to-face meeting, a really important step forward for the relationship. And I really must say, George Brandis did a great job to make sure that all came off as well as it did as the High Commissioner in London. He's really been a pivotal figure in making sure that's continued on in the way that we'd hope, whilst we've all been having to do things via Zoom or Teams or whatever platform is of your preference.
And look, that's a great segue to my next question, which was going to be around what's happening in Australia at the moment and the view from the UK. We've had our own problems over the last year and a half. We weren't as badly affected by COVID-19 as the UK was, but as everybody knows, we're now in the middle of a trade war with our largest trading partner, China, and travel to and from Australia is at a virtual standstill. How do you think the business community in the UK views what's going on here? And how do you think the circumstances in Australia have affected that bilateral trade relationship, if they have at all?
Look, I think there's probably a few different points to take at that. I mean, I think Australia's relationship with China is an important one that we need to be very careful and thought out with. And I think we've probably jumped a little bit ahead of the game in some ways on a number of issues that have probably inflamed the tensions between our countries. And that's spilled over, unfortunately, into challenging situations for a variety of sectors, barley, wine and others in terms of exports from Australia to China. And I guess the good thing that we've seen in some ways is that particularly, for example, wine, where Australia has about 20% of the UK wine market already, the premium quality stuff that we've been sending to China is perhaps getting more of an airing and consumption in the UK than it has previously. And there are certainly other opportunities. Australia exports barley, for example, to the UK for creation of various alcoholic products, amongst other things. There are opportunities to diversify our trading partnerships, but I think the reality is China is our number one trading partner for a variety of reasons, and they're a closer geography, and I'd like to see that return to a level of stability. But as I say to many people, when you sit down with a financial advisor to talk about your own investments, diversity is one of the important factors that if you put all your eggs in one basket, then you're subject to bigger implications when there are shocks. And Australia's been very lucky in terms of the last two shocks, this one and the GFC, that we had such a strong trading relationship with China, and particularly on the minerals commodity side, to underpin a continuation of a growth story. Even though we did go into recession here in Australia for the first time in 28 years this time, we've rebounded very strongly, and record high iron ore prices obviously underpin a lot of that, and a lot of that sold to China. So I think there's obviously some interesting parts to how all of that fits together. And I think it's important that we try and have great relationships with as many people as we can and try and sell our products to as many markets as we can to give ourselves the best risk-weighted asset portfolio or trading portfolio as we can going forward.
And speaking of relationships, I wanted to ask you your thoughts on how Australia's relationship with the UK has evolved over time, because obviously our two countries have been inextricably linked since Captain Cook showed up here in 1770, and sometimes I feel as though we view it as this permanent, unchanging thing that's just there. But obviously, things change, things develop. I wondered what kind of evolution you've seen since you've been working in this space, because it's been quite a while now.
Yeah, it has been quite a while. I've been doing this job, I think it's 11 and a half years nearly now. So it's been a great evolving period, actually, not least because of Brexit and the opportunity of a future free trade agreement between the two countries. But realistically, trade and investment stocks in both countries have gone up and seen considerable growth over that period. In 2019, we saw stock of investment from Australia into the UK and from the UK into Australia go up by over $100 billion. And that's now a $1.1 trillion two-way investment relationship. And the UK is Australia's second largest investor. The UK basically invests as much as the whole rest of Europe into Australia on an annual basis over recent years. So that's not to downplay the European investment. We want that as well, as we all love to have partners from all over the place, exactly as my last answer alluded to. We want diversity. But that strength of that relationship, I mean, it really has in the last 4 or 5 years taken on a real warmth and a new direction. I mean, I remember back to 2011 when William Hague was the first foreign secretary to visit Australia in 18 years. And it probably shows that the UK and certainly had, I wouldn't say neglected, but had probably taken for granted a little bit the strength of that relationship. And that relationship is always going to be strong enough to withstand periods where we're perhaps a little bit more indifferent to each other. But the real focus, particularly since the Brexit referendum and the opportunity to think more broadly and more globally for Britain, has really brought it to think about how it engages in the Indo-Pacific. And if you read the integrated review and they talk about the Indo-Pacific tilt that the UK are looking to go on, that partly is driven around security measures, but it's also driven around economic opportunity. And they see Australia as a great partner in this part of the world to participate in those opportunities.
And there is so much connection between the two economies already. Where do you see the opportunities for particularly smaller firms from both countries now and going forward?
Look, I think the easy thing to say on that is the most important thing for both economies is we're really both services-based economies now. And yeah, iron ore, as I mentioned earlier, gets a big write-up in Australia on a regular basis, as do a number of other commodities. But when you think about pre-pandemic sense, international students and tourism, particularly on tourism, the UK have been a tremendous partner, both in terms of their investments into tourism infrastructure in Australia, and don't have to go very far to find hotels and theme parks and things even as iconic as the Sydney Eye, you know, the Centrepoint Tower being managed by UK companies in that space. But with services more broadly, there's such a great opportunity for alignment, whether that's in emerging spaces like fintech or regtech, whether that's in more traditional financial services, legal services, engineering, particularly around infrastructure. We all know that, you know, recoveries, governments like to lean on infrastructure particularly hard to try and get, you know, shovel-ready projects, as they call them, out the door, and needing the right engineering, architecture, design. All of those things are important things that we're able to both participate in the UK economy on, but also have opportunities for the UK to participate here. And that services side is a really important part, I think, of the future. And so hopefully through the FTA, mobility of people will be, and recognition of professional qualifications and standards will really be enshrined to try and encourage and draw out those opportunities. And that means engineering and architectural firms, some of which are quite small, can participate in each other's markets. That means that people who are looking to export, particularly if you're thinking about, you know, Australia's wonderful food and beverage offerings that we can get into the UK. You know, we've had a couple of clients actually over the last 12 months or so get product into places like Harrods, you know, iconic, high-level, high-quality, premium products into really top quality stores in the UK. It's fantastic. We've got so much more we can do. We just need the opportunity to be able to do it a little bit easier than currently. And those are the hopeful outcomes, I guess, of the FTA.
And there are some programs in place to support companies who are looking either to come to Australia or to go to the UK. And I mean, there's a lot going on in that space. Do you want to mention a couple of the key programs that, you know, have already provided a lot of support? I mean, I'm thinking particularly perhaps of the FinTech Bridge or the Space Bridge. Do you want to pick out a couple of those and just tell us a little bit about what's going on in those spaces and why that stuff is so cool?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the FinTech Bridge was the original model, and it was set up when Prime Minister Morrison was but the lowly treasurer. And he and the Chancellor of the Exchequer at the time, Philip Hammond, set up this bridge. The basic premise of which is to try and do exactly what I've just said. It really to try and pull opportunities for UK fintech into Australia and similarly for Australian fintech into the UK by providing sandboxes for them to showcase what they're doing with the regulator, to trial products in each other's markets, to be able to utilise the services of Austrade and the Department of International Trade, as well as the industry bodies themselves and you know, third parties like ourselves as, at the Australian British Chamber of Commerce, to help identify the opportunities, help them to establish themselves, and doing it in a way that's hopefully as regulatorily aligned as possible. And that will then allow a freedom of movement of IP and an opportunity between the two countries. So that's obviously clearly one part, but you know, there have been lots of other things that have been in play as well. The UK has a variety of programs that support exporters from the UK to find markets in other countries. And the Department of International Trade here in Australia, led on the trade side by Joe Freeman, who's the Consul General up in Brisbane and head of trade for DIT across Australia and New Zealand. She has a fantastic team that can support people coming into market here. Jennifer McKinley has a team in London. She heads up, she's the Senior Trade Commissioner for Austrade in London. She has a team now of people, and that's a relatively new piece for Austrade, is having people who are export advisors on the ground in market to help people export, not just into the UK, but across Europe. So those things are there. And of course, on the Australian side, one of the great programs that's been oversubscribed, I think, ever since it started, is the export market development grants that Australian companies can apply for to help with their marketing into new territories across the world. And the UK is obviously a great place to come and do business. Good to be able to avail yourself of those sorts of opportunities as well.
And for people who are thinking about, you know, what kind of help the Chamber might be able to provide, can you just give us a sense of that?
Yeah, look, the Chamber's role is pretty simple. We're here to help. And what that help is really depends on who you are and what you know about what you're trying to do. And we're happy to sit down with members and people who are interested in trading between Australia and the UK, or investing or being a participant in one form or another between the two countries, and talk about what we see in terms of the market. But importantly, behind that, we've got a network of nearly 30,000 individuals, both here in Australia and in the UK, and indeed in a variety of other markets as well, have come through into our consciousness. And it's really a matter of understanding what you're trying to achieve, and then allowing us to help you connect to those key people, whether that's helping find new clients, helping you build your supply chain, whether that's providing the right legal and financial advice. The Chamber has members that do all of those things, and we're very keen to help businesses find the right people for their business to be able to do that business more effectively.
David, it's been great having you on the show today. Thank you for coming in to talk about all things Australia and UK. Have you got any final thoughts for business owners and CEOs in Australia looking to go to the UK, or for business owners and founders in the UK looking to come out here?
Look, I think that the message probably is the same for both. Come and talk to us and let us know what you're up to. I think one of the things that we often see, and is probably a little bit disappointing in some ways, is Australian companies think that the UK is just the same as Australia, and the UK tends to think the same about Australia. And so really, it's understanding the nuance. It's understanding how you need to approach the market. And we're happy to have those conversations with you right up front and make sure that you get off on the right foot. So please get in touch. Let us know what you're up to, and we'd be delighted to help.
Fantastic. Great talking to you. We'll chat again soon.
Thanks very much, Cynthia.
Hi, everyone. This is Matt again. And just a few things before you head off. Firstly, if you feel you have gained valuable insights from the show, make sure to subscribe to the podcast so you don't miss another episode. More importantly, don't forget to tell your fellow entrepreneur and business leader friends that this is the best podcast to tune into if they're looking to take on the world with their products and services. Also, if you are loving the podcast, please take the time to rate and review, as it's one of the best ways for us to get loads of free value into the hands of other entrepreneurs. And lastly, make sure to visit DearinAssociates.com. That's DEARIN associates.com, where we have plenty of free resources and tools for you to get clarity and build momentum with your international venture. If you go there, you'll find the Blueprint to International Success, ebooks, our latest blog posts, and more. So be sure to check it out. And until next time, this is me encouraging you to expand your vision and wishing you all the best as you continue your global journey.